Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Roger Devlin. He has a new book out called Sexual Utopia and Power. It is published by Countercurrents Publishing. Roger, it's great having you on.
Hi, Robert, likewise.
So you wrote an essay, basically the essay by the same name, Sexual
Yes.
Utopia and Power, about how long ago did you write this? It must have been about like 5 years ago.
Oh, I started Sexual Utopia and Power in about December of 2005, and it was published in, must have been the summer edition of the Occidental Quarterly in 2006. So it goes back a ways now, 9 years.
And how much of an impact did that article have? How much influence did it have?
Well, it's certainly much more than anything else I've ever written. I write on a great deal of subjects. I review a lot of books. I've never had anything like the reaction that I've had to my writings on feminism. The Sexual Utopia and Power essay leads off this book, and the book includes six other essays on related topics, all about feminism. The subtitle is The Feminist Revolt Against Civilization.
So you're from an academic background. What originally got you interested in these topics?
Well, it wasn't through anything academic. I do have a degree in philosophy, and my dissertation, essentially, was published as Alexander Kojève and the Outcome of Modern Thought, a book which has probably never sold any more than Sexual Utopia and Power did in its first week of release. I got interested in this, in the subject of sex and feminism, by slumming around on the internet. I went to chat sites where guys would talk about their messy divorces and about their terrible experiences trying to date American women, and even things like pickup sites. And I learned a great deal, and I came to see sexual relations in a whole different way. A lot of conservatives, their ideas about sex comes from the monogamistic traditions of their youth and of their ancestors, and they really don't know what young people are dealing with in a sexual world that's totally Darwinian, where there are no social constraints in favor of monogamy. And I think they've misdiagnosed considerably what has gone wrong and what we need to do to fix it. So that's why I wrote this book. In a way, it's a polemic against well-meaning conservatives whose policies I often agree with, but who I think just really don't know what's going on with the sexual revolution.
So I think it's interesting to point out like the origins of the sexual revolution. So there's sort of a misconception that it began in the 1960s or that it began with the Frankfurt School. It actually goes back much further than that.
Well, yes, it was some time in coming. I think that something began in America about the time of the First World War or the 1920s. That's about when divorce first came to be publicly accepted. And Wright, Kinsey was doing his work back in the 40s, I think. It's been a long time coming, but I guess it became undeniable to everybody since about the late 60s that, you know, something has broken down.
Mm-hmm. So in the 1920s, there was sort of a first sexual revolution, and there was a lot of divorces, a lot of illegitimacy. And then the Great Depression happened, and a lot of children ended up in orphanages, and there was kind of a backlash against that by the generation that grew up, by the generation that grew up in the 20s and 30s.
Now, what are you talking about? Like the Depression and World War II generation? They're the ones. They did a sort of a rear guard action against the emerging sexual revolution and produced the baby boom, which was a kind of one generation wonder of monogamous procreation. But it broke down as soon as the children came of age and had never really had to, you know, had never really experienced any of the kind of hardship that their parents had. So, in a way, sexual morality, they say that it tends to be best among the middle classes and bad among the lower classes and the upper classes. The lower classes, because they're not intelligent enough to understand the importance of sexual morality, and the upper classes, because they can pay for their, you know, their capers. And what happened in 1960, in the 1960s, was really a kind of a revolution of rising expectations. The sexual revolution that we know, that began in the late 60s, is something that was really a product of post-war prosperity, I believe.
Yeah, I think class played a major role, because that's, we saw the beginning of a large middle class that was created at that time. Mm-hmm. And now we're kind of seeing an economic structure where you're just seeing the very rich and the very poor.
Yeah, that's true. One of the essays in my book is called Back to Africa, Sexual Atavism in the Modern West. One of the things I argue is that the sexual practices of the decadent West come to resemble those of one of the more primitive parts of the world, West Africa. Even feminism, strange as it sounds, leads to a kind of West African sexual pattern of what are called matrifocal families and irresponsible men.
So this is across the whole economic and demographic and racial spectrum. It's affecting everyone,
yes,
from the poor to the rich.
Well, of course, you know, it's not an accident that the return of African mating patterns began, first of all, among American blacks. As soon as the welfare system kicked in, they had made a considerable progress, actually, in conforming to the Western model of monogamy and father support of families. But that fell apart, and the African pattern reasserted itself very quickly after the reforms of the 1960s, the Great Society program and so forth. But now whites are going the same way. You know, we all are ultimately of African origin, so we're all vulnerable to that kind of atavism or atavistic behavior.
Mm-hmm. What were the motivations of the leaders of the sexual revolution? Was it personal? Was it economic? Was it idealistic? Or all of the above?
Well, I think they were, to a great extent, they were simply naive people. There's a wonderful quote. I can't remember where exactly it comes from, but one of the leaders in the 1950s, one of the people, I think, working with Kinsey, acknowledged that they really had no idea what a sexually liberated society would look like. And I think that's true. They really were going into uncharted waters and didn't know what was ahead of them. But now we know, and it turns out to be something extremely primitive. It turns out to be a mating pattern that resembles that of other primates, where the females try to mate with the alpha male, and the men compete to become the alpha male to mate with all the females. And obviously, fewer children get born, and they have a much harder time growing up.
Saying fewer children get born, Africa has the highest birth rates in the world.
Oh, that's true. But you know, we that's true. This is something I point out in that essay, which originally appeared in American Renaissance back in 2008. The difference there is that American liberated sexuality came in about with cheap and effective contraception. So yeah, in that way, we're actually doing worse than Africa. We're practicing a rather primitive mating pattern and sex that is not centered on family and procreation. And at the same time, we're not procreating. At least the Africans are doing that. So we have you know, I'm sure you're familiar with Ed Wilson and Philippe Rushton and the RK strategizing reproductive strategies. You can, you know, some organisms reproduce at an extremely high rate but take no care of their young. That's called an R reproductive strategy, and human beings have them, and particularly white and Asian human beings have a K strategy of having fewer children, but taking very good care of them. But now, thanks to the sexual revolution, we're really practicing, like, we've combined the worst of both worlds. We're having fewer children and practicing low investment parenting, really, thanks to divorce and birth control. So it's a very serious crisis, and it's, you know, this has been going on now for 50 years, and it's certainly been long enough to say, look, the evidence is in. We do know what a sexually liberated society looks like, and we're going to have to find our way back to the ways of our fathers if we want our Western civilization to survive all of its threats, demographic and military and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, those are examples. So, like, West Africa is an example of an extremely R-selected society.
Yes.
Basically, like, Europeans and Northeast Asians are the only two groups that has really been capable of sustaining civilization.
Right, yes, the K-strategizers. Now, Africans are very much K-strategizers compared to the rest of the animal kingdom, but not compared to Europeans, or, you know, we're Europeans and Northeast Asians are about the most the strongest example there is of a strategy, reproductive strategy. And we have to, you know, that's ultimately what civilization rests upon. It's just another word for high investment parenting. Giving children a stable and supportive environment to grow up in. That's what civilization ultimately depends on, and that's what we're losing.
So the West African model, is it specifically West Africa or all of Africa in general? Is there something unique about West Africa?
Yeah, it originated in West Africa. The what we know, you know, the Negro race originated in West Africa and later spread out over the African continent. The purest example of this kind of behavior is found in West Africa, which is where our black African population came from. There are slight differences in other parts of Africa. Yeah, it's African in general, but the purest example of this type of reproductive strategy is in West Africa, where you have a female farming economy. The essential thing about West Africa is that women produce most of the food. They don't need men to support them. And as soon as our remote ancestors wandered out of Africa and into Asia and Europe, it was not really possible to do that. The families required male provisioning, and that's one reason why white people have a greater tendency toward monogamy, and why monogamy took a little longer to break down among whites than it did among blacks. But ultimately, it is breaking down.
How much of a role did religion play? Do you think Christianity was a major, like, the main factor, as opposed to other religions?
Well, you know, it's interesting that Christianity is not the only religion that pays a great deal of attention to sex. My hypothesis is simply that religion is the only force powerful enough to counteract something as primal as the sex instinct, so it has an important role to play in the sexual disciplining of society, so to speak. It's not unique to Christianity. You wouldn't think that God would be so interested in, you know, what we do in our bedrooms, but this I think is the reason. It's a form of social discipline. It's the strongest tool in civilization's arsenal, really, to try to control the human sex instinct.
Do you think social conservatives and religious conservatives are misguided to argue these points based on biblical morality? Arguments are primarily based on science and secular arguments.
Yeah, it's basically evolutionary psychology. I'm not a professional in that field, but that's the kind of argument I use. But it comes out, my book ends up being what I call an unorthodox defense of orthodoxy. That's a phrase I take from the American poet John Crow Ransom. It's ultimately a defense of the traditional Christian conception of marriage. But that's what I offer. But it's not offered through a theological argument. It's done through a completely secular and sort of science-based argument. So you don't actually, you know, you don't need the Bible. It's fine. It's as I say, it's not an accident that religion is used to discipline society sexually. But you don't need to take. It's not something you need to take on faith. It's something that, as I show in this book, I think you can see for yourself why monogamy is the best arrangement, certainly for our people, for the European people.
Conservatives, they tend to come across as kind of like prudes who don't want younger people to have fun, or they just view men as predatory.
Yes, exactly. I mean, men are predators in the exact same sense in which women are all prostitutes. I mean, yes, every man is trying to mate, and that's the way it's supposed to be. And yes, every woman looks to give herself to the highest bidder, and that's the way it should be too. In a way, one of the motives of my writing this book was I was so angry at the traditional conservatives who would, it's a kind of misguided gallantry. They don't want to blame women for the sexual revolution. They want to make it look like it's something that men devised and that just sort of happened to women. And really, both sexes were involved, but ultimately, it has sexual patterns, mating patterns, have more to do with what women do than with what men do, because this is the definition of the sexes. The female is the sex with the fewest gametes, the fewest sex cells, and therefore the female represents the supply of sex, and the male represents the demand. And so if you want to regulate sex, you're not going to do it as well by trying to get men to practice chastity as you are by concentrating your message on women. And so that's why traditional sexual morality was mostly a matter of getting women to be the guardians of monogamy. And it was sheer common sense. Stop a practice, you have to cut off the supply. There's no sense in trying to work at the demand end. It's just an inefficient way of going about it. So the situation has gone so far that men really can't do much about it. If women don't change their behavior patterns, what can one guy do? He can be celibate, but plenty of other guys out there are going to be happy to take advantage of loose and misguided women who want to mate on sheer instinct instead of getting married.
And these social conservatives, I think some examples like Bill Bennett is one of them who's written articles about this.
Mm-hmm.
They've written countless articles about how young men are lazy and they need to work harder and contribute to society and get married.
Well, this is what I say about that. There's been, as well as a sexual revolution, there's been an economic revolution of women going into the workplace beginning in the 19 really actually it really got underway in the 80s during the Reagan years. That's the year that women started going en masse into the workplace. And what this has done is, first of all, it's driven down men's wages. When there's a greater supply of work out there, the price of it, or wages, are lower. You know, if women were to suddenly leave the workforce, employers would find that they had to pay men much higher wages to keep them working. You know, and at one time, even socialists, even progressives, wanted to keep women out of the workforce. They viewed working women as something like strike breakers, you know, who were cutting into their husbands' wages. And this is something that's it was forgotten first on the left, and now even the right doesn't know it. But there were people, you know, back in the day before universal working women. Phyllis Schlafly warned women, if you keep on demanding the right to work as a privilege, you're going to wake up someday and discover that you no longer have a choice. You're going to have to work. And that's what's happened now. Women, whether they want to or not, you know, the pioneers, they thought it was really exciting going out and having a job and having your own income and being independent. But now women just do it because they have to. They can't rely on a male income because of this economic revolution, which has cut everybody's wages and really benefited nobody except the government, which is able to collect more money in taxes from two-income families. I favor a full return to the male-headed, male-provisioned family.
So if you look at the history of, like, originally the same was with the labor unions, and they opposed immigration. And I think corporations and corporate interests have played a big role in promoting policies like feminism and mass immigration, because it's
exactly, and for the same reason,
depress wages,
cheap wages.
As possible.
Yes, it's the same thing economically. It's the same thing. The capitalist support of mass immigration of low-skilled people and getting women into the workforce. There's no reason why society as a whole should listen to them. They're arguing their own economic interests, period. You know, even the right doesn't know this anymore. You know, the right has forgotten this, has forgotten that there's nothing conservative about having everybody free to, you know, free employment or employment on demand for women.
Mm-hmm. And the other factor is women expect men to make more than they are. So a lot of women are not willing to marry men who make the same or less than they do.
That's right. That's an aspect of hypergamy, which is the big word that I seem to have rendered fashionable again. Yes, women naturally want to mate up. They want to mate with a good provider. And when feminists were first trying to get women into the workplace, they made a pitch. They said to both women and men, they said that men were just going to love it when women were making their own money and they, the men, no longer had to support them. They thought it was, and they also thought it was going to. They also promised that women were not going to be as materialistic and look for a mate on the basis of earning power. Well, that's not the way it turned out at all, and the reason it didn't turn out this way is that the female instinct to mate with a good provider is just that. It's an instinct. It's not a rational calculation. In a hunter-gatherer society, the females try to mate with the biggest, strongest, and best hunter. In a capitalist society, they try to mate with the man with the most earning power. And if they're making, say, $60,000 a year, it doesn't mean that they'll be willing to mate with a man with less money. Rather, they'll only see a man as a possible provider and therefore as a mate if he's making twice as much as she is, $100,000-$120,000 a year. So it narrows the woman's field of vision. Women in the workplace economically independent are only willing to consider a rather small number of men. And so you find these guys, yeah, it's true, you'll find a lot of bachelor men nowadays who are not working real hard and trying to climb the corporate pyramid, but I say, in contrast to Bill Bennett, it's not just that the men are lazy and irresponsible, it's because the whole society has been revolutionized economically to make the traditional male role superfluous. And when you make man's function in society superfluous, you really don't have any right to blame men for no longer knocking themselves out to try to fulfill that traditional function. It really makes a lot of sense for a lot of young guys out there to say, screw it, I'll just, you know, I'll work 25 hours a week. If I need sex, I'll go to a prostitute, and I won't kill myself trying to earn a family income in this society where there are fewer and fewer jobs that offer a family income, and where women most often end up divorcing their husbands anyway. You know, it's the odds are stacked up so bad against young men starting out their lives today that a lot of them really figure there's no point in trying. And I actually agree. I think that society is going to have to be reorganized along other lines before it would be reasonable to scold men into marrying. In fact, if we brought back the family wage and employment discrimination against women, we wouldn't have to nag men. They would start marrying again the way that, you know, the way they used to. It's a different set of incentives. You produce a more traditional society, you have the traditional incentives. You produce this feminist society, and there's just no incentive for a man to try to better himself or better his position.
Do you think some of these trends could have negative impacts on women in the long term?
They're having negative impacts now.
One thing I think is happening is as the middle class is being wiped out, you have a lot of women delaying marriage, like well into their 30s, and they'll have problems finding providers just because of the whole economic decline in the middle class.
Sure. Well, one of the things, another change that we could make that wouldn't involve revolutionizing the whole economy would be the idea of getting women to marry first. Women should be having babies when they are most fertile, in their late teens and early 20s. And we can tell women you don't have to forego a career, but you can have your career, you know, people are living much longer and staying healthy much longer. You can have a career once your children are out of the house. It's possible for a woman to start working now when she's 40 or so and still enjoy a rather long career. But children have to come first. It's much more important. The future belongs to the fertile, and we have to get our young women having children again before we worry about any other issue, really.
So overall, would you say that these problems harm men a lot more? Like, what are some examples of ways this harms women in the long run?
Well, I've heard stories about successful guys at the top of the corporate pyramid being getting these annoying calls from dating services, desperate 45-year-old women are all looking for these same few guys, and the guys are not interested in them. We have a lot of frustrated spinsters already. You know, we just look at the anger. I mean, this is not something that many, many people have noticed how angry women are today. Not just anti-feminists like me, and why so many of them are on drugs, on antidepressant medicine. This is because of our unnatural way of life, our unnatural economy, and family system.
So back to the original sexual revolution. So originally it began, you mentioned in a previous interview, it began with a sense of euphoria.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, all revolutions do. I mean, there was dancing in the streets when Mao Zedong came to power in China. You know, there was in the, you know, that's just what happens. Yes, people initially it was a matter of shooting the reins and just people enjoying sex, and there was a certain amount of euphoria about it. But you know, Paul Craig Roberts also mentioned. He was actually teaching college at the time, and he says a lot of guys were not really sure about it. On the one hand, it was nice getting relief for your raging hormones, but on the other hand, it was harder to find a girl of your own. All the girls kind of became public property and were passed around between the guys, and guys certainly don't want that. So it wasn't all good, even for men.
What I see as the main reason is originally when it happened back then, we mm-hmm. saw it a society where there was a strong social ties, stronger social capital. I think
yes, right.
That's why there was more of a sense of people coming together and enjoying themselves. But
right.
as things progressed, people became more disconnected from each other. Now you have a lot of... I think there's a lot more social isolation and disconnection.
Yes. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's we're a much more urbanized population. Another thing, and I kind of regret not saying this in my book. If you go back to movies, books set in the days before the American Sexual Revolution, you'll find young women worrying tremendously about their reputation. It was a big concept. A girl could not afford to get a bad reputation with guys. But now in these, you know, the megalopolises that we live in now, there really is effectively no such constraint on women because there's an effectively endless supply of men out there. They don't need to worry the way they do in a small town or rural environment, that men are going to talk to each other and that their prospects are going to be harmed by their own bad behavior. So they do behave badly. I've read stories about women going on a date with a different guy every day to get their lunches paid for in New York City. They actually sign on to some dating site, and they date a different guy every day for months on end just as a way to save money on their meals, you know.
What was the role that Playboy and Cosmo magazine played? And basically, they both sent out a utopian model, one to men and one to women.
Yes. Yeah, now this is another thing where the average conservative journalist doesn't really understand what's happening right. Everybody deplores Playboy and pornography, and I don't want to disagree there, but there's not much attention paid to the female sexual utopia sold by people like, you know, magazines like Cosmopolitan or the romance novel industry. It's interesting that romance novels really boomed about 10 years after pornography. And there are some sources that claim that half of paperback books sold in the United States now are romance novels. And these are very much the female analog to pornography. They're selling women impossible fantasies, and the women indulge in this at the expense of dating a real man, a real peer, and actually starting a family. And it's worse. I believe it's worse than pornography in its social effects because women are the supply side for sex. A man cannot, by reading Playboy, decide that he's going to go out there and sleep with 100 different women. He can't do that unless he's very attractive. But a woman actually can go looking for Mr. Goodbar, looking for her perfect alpha. And so romance novels and Cosmo, they have more bad effects in the real world because women have so much more sexual power than men do. But again, this is something that you won't find people talking about because they don't One reason is just that men who write about this subject don't understand female sexuality, and the other is a misplaced sense of gallantry. They don't want to criticize women.
Yeah, like they're very much like they like to complain about men using porn, or men going to strip clubs or prostitutes and stuff like that.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone suggest that romance fiction should be outlawed, which of course many people want to get rid of pornography. It's just, you know, it's something, it's not the way people think. When it comes to women, they don't think in the same way. But I think if we could get young people marrying at an early age again, porn and romance novels would more or less wither on the vine anyway. You know, it's not a matter of getting rid of those industries first. We got to start with young people and get them forming families when they're young and fertile.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I mean, you're not going to get rid of pornography. It's on the internet. It's here to stay.
Yeah, but if you get most guys a wife when they're in their 20s, they're not going to be looking at it as much, or, you know. So that's the way I think we should go about it. The same thing with homosexuality. It's a symptom. The rise of homosexual politics. Some traditionalists think that the homos are the cause of our cheapening marriage and of declining sexual morality, and they're not. They're the flotsam on the surface. They're a symptom of a much deeper problem, which is occurring among heterosexuals. We got to work on the normal people. In other words, normal heterosexual people have to get their act together, and we have to make certain legal changes, like making divorce harder to obtain, presumptive father custody of children. So if a woman leaves her husband, she has to leave her children too. That would eliminate most divorce right there in one fell swoop. And we got to concentrate on the lives of ordinary people and family formation, and not worry about symptoms like gay pride parades and romance fiction and pornography. That stuff, I think, will get under control once an ordinary monogamous sort of regime is established again.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, mainstream social conservatives, like, the issues they care about are homosexuality, abortion, and, I mean, they're really,
yeah,
really stupid issues that are not, I mean, homosexuals don't pose a threat at all to society.
Mm.
They're 2% of the population. With the
abortion
issue, I mean, a lot of social conservatives want to ban abortion, but I think it would actually be a disaster to ban abortion, because what would happen is basically the amount of illegitimate children in poverty would double if you ban abortion. It would be a disaster.
Yes, it's very possible. I don't know. I don't know what would happen if abortion were banned at this point. I don't think it's going to happen. I don't know. Maybe some people some couples would actually stay together if abortion were banned. I don't know. But, yeah, you're right. There's a tendency to mistake effects and symptoms for causes in the ordinary conservative. Yeah. Anyway, that's why I wrote the book. I try to explain what's really going on at a deeper level.
Do you also see a trend where there are some men who build up their careers and they become successful in their 30s, and they have women their own age who have delayed marriage, who now are interested in them, but these men are
want
not
the younger
that enthusiastic
women. Sure.
About. Yeah, they want. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. One of the things that I would advise a young man starting out today is, don't even think about women when you're in your 20s. Get your finances squared away. Get somewhere in the world. I know that's tough, but for those who can do it, they'll be in a much better position than a woman who puts career before everything.
In another interview, you were talking about how conservatives think that pedophilia is the next boundary after homosexuality. But, I mean, it's important to point out that that's one issue where things have gone, like, the whole pedophile hysteria has gotten a lot more draconian since the sexual revolution.
Yes, that's an odd thing. But it's certainly true. I grew up in the sexual revolution, and I don't remember hearing about pedophilia in the 1970s and 80s the way I've been hearing about it since. I don't know why that is. It's gone in the opposite direction from everything else. The more sexually degenerate we become, the more people seem to be focusing on pedophilia, and I don't know quite why that is. I don't know whether there's more pedophilia now than there was in the past. I have a pretty good hunch that some of it is hype, though. Some of it is just feminists like the idea because it's another, you know, it's like rape. It's just another way to make men look bad. By the way, if you want to stop child abuse, the best thing you can do is to restore the father-headed family, because natural fathers are the least likely of anybody in the world to abuse a child. One problem that has gotten worse since the divorce revolution is stepfathers, unscrupulous stepfathers going after stepdaughters. That would not be a problem if we had if we brought back fault divorce and presumptive father custody.
What do you think about the attitudes towards teen sex are very contradictory? On one hand, teenage girls have been sexualized by the media. But then,
right,
on the other hand, like statutory rape laws have gotten more draconian, and it's gotten to the point where if a man mentions like he finds an 18-year-old girl attractive, that's called like pedophilia.
Right. It's absurd. Well, I think in a way maybe the solution is more teen sex. It's in the form of getting young women married in their late teens. Americans are marrying much too late now, and particularly the women. In some countries, the average age of a woman at first marriage is above 30 now. This is very abnormal. I remember some years ago seeing a People magazine cover about, the title was Hollywood's Young Brides, and it had a couple of examples of movie starlets who were getting married at 23. Now, for most of U.S. history, a 23-year-old bride was an old bride. At the height of the post-war baby boom, the average age of an American woman at first marriage was 20. That's the average. Lots of them were younger. And I think if Westerners could go back to that, to seeing marriage of girls in their late teens as perfectly normative, it would be an enormous advantage to us in the civilizational struggle that lies ahead of us. But you know, to do that, we have to restore presumptive father custody, fault divorce, and the family wage, I think, to get guys to marry women like this.
Can you talk about your essay, Female Masochism?
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's one I delayed writing for a long time. I tried to do research on the subject, and I couldn't find much written on the subject. It is a traditional idea. It's very widespread, a kind of folk belief that there is a masochistic element to female sexuality. And if you think as an evolutionist, it's easy to understand why. Gallantry that warms the conservative's heart is a wonderful thing, but it's a cultural achievement. It's not where we come from. It's not the way it was in Africa. It's not the way it is in Africa still. It's not the way it was in a hunter-gatherer society. A man could hit a woman, and there's nothing she could do about it. So it's not surprising when you view it in that light that women came to see male violence as sexy in a way, as something specifically masculine. It's as much violence is as masculine a thing as intrigue and subterfuge are feminine. You know, I say that the battle of the sexes is a battle of force versus cunning. You know, women learned to hide their true thoughts and to keep men confused about them. That's a woman's basic sexual strategy. She tries to keep the man she's dating in doubt as to what she's actually thinking. And this is because women throughout history have had to, and throughout prehistory, have had to deal with men who could pop them one if they felt like it, you know. So men have the advantage of strength, but women have the advantage of really kind of better intelligence and better understanding of personal relations, and also, you know, just plain an ability to lie. So I don't get too concerned for this reason about all the weepy feminist talk about ending violence against women. I say in that essay, I'd be more enthusiastic about the idea of ending violence against women if there were a parallel movement to end fraud against men. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. So,
you referenced, there was this article from Norway about the Pakistani Muslims there.
Oh yes, did you read that? Did you find that?
You referenced it. I think it was originally posted on the site Fjordman's blog.
Oh, it may be. I don't know where I read it now, but yes, it's a terrible. There's a terrible situation. I imagine it's the same in Sweden and in these other northern European countries with high immigration. The women being all attracted to the foreigners. And what I read is that in Norway, these Muslim guys will go about in packs. Norway is a very individualistic society, as other northern European societies are. So the immigrants will go around in packs, and the Norwegians will be going around by themselves a great deal. And when the immigrant gangs come upon a defenseless single Norwegian man, they'll jump him and they'll beat him up. And what's happening is the women find these guys attractive because they are socially dominant. I mean, it's a pretty clear sign of dominance when you're the one beating up somebody else and he's not able to beat up you. Now, and this is a good example also of how very, very primitive the female sex instinct is. What they just see that the immigrant guys are beating up the native guys, and they perceive that as the immigrant guys are more masculine. The guys know that these immigrant gangs will flee from a fair fight. If it's one-on-one or if it's three-on-three, the immigrants will run. They will not face down a Norwegian in a fair fight. They're not actually brave. They're cowardly people. They're bullies who like to beat up people when they're in a position of strength, but not otherwise. But this doesn't seem to matter to the girls. The girls will become concubines in their nubile years, when they're in high school, university age. They become concubines to these guys from Pakistan or Iraq or someplace like that, who use them, who enjoy them in their, you know, at their peak attractiveness and peak fertility. And then, of course, they go on and marry a woman from their own tribe and have a family of seven Muslim children. And, if I were a Norwegian man, I would have nothing to do. I would be very mean about it. I would have nothing to do with any woman who ever dated an immigrant man. And that's, But something's got to be done about it. It's just horrible to see the emasculation of European men. This idea, also, it's spread to some extent by the media, this notion that these rather primitive men are somehow more masculine than European men. What they really are is just unrefined. But, you know, the female instinct is so primitive that sometimes they'll even just see barbarism as, they'll confuse barbarism with strength.
Part of the reason why Islamic invasions have been successful throughout history is they promised the women of the enemy as a war booty. Hypothetically, if nationalists were to come to power in Norway, I think white Europeans are very moralistic. I don't think they would be taking, like, teenage Pakistani girls as, like, war booty. I think whites are just too moralistic.
No.
But hypothetically, it's not moralistic, but I think they would be more successful from a strategic standpoint.
It's a very interesting theme. Anthropologists, when they're studying studying social conflict, this is how they determine who the winners are, who gets the women. The males, the tribe that is taking the other tribe's women is the dominant tribe. And it's going to be interesting to see just how long European men put up with this. The elites, of course, think there's nothing wrong with it, but they're playing with fire because the sex instinct, including the female, the instinct to protect your own tribe's woman, it's something extremely primitive. It goes deep in our nature, and I think we're going to see some very interesting things happen in Europe in the coming years. Maybe men forming bands of the sort that Jack Donovan recommends.
And that's another point you've made in an interview, is that what's happening is the people who, on one hand, religious people are reproducing more. So on one hand, people who are more social, who are the secular people are dying out, religious people are growing in numbers, and the people remaining could become stronger. But the problem, like in Europe, the huge numbers of Muslims is like, That needs to be dealt with.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I think it's hard for me to imagine our side triumphing politically and then just restoring a healthy society by changing the laws. I don't think that's the way it's going to happen. I think that it's going to happen. I think that positive change will come eventually, but not before things get worse for a while. And I think what's going to happen is the people with the traditional ways of life are going to become the parents of the next generation, and they'll be left standing when no one else is. And it'll bode well for the future. We'll have fewer people, but they'll be well-raised and raised on good principles, and they'll be stronger than the average Huffington Post reader of today who doesn't believe in anything, you know. So I don't see any political victory in the near term, but in the course of a generation, things are going to change in a lot of interesting and not entirely predictable ways. It's really the generation coming of age now that's going to have to fight the big battles.
Yeah, I don't think people should focus so much on fixing political systems, but the key is creating subcultures.
Yeah, exactly. People should not be. I'm depressed by how much money people give to political candidates. It's such a waste, even on our side. We should be creating little enclaves. I don't plan to join Craig Cobb in North Dakota anytime soon. But I mean, somebody's going to have to do something like that. All the other people have their own enclaves, the Hasidic Jews and the Asians. Why shouldn't we have some liberated zones, shall we say, to raise our own children who can take back the West when we're gone?
Yeah, like some of those groups, like Orthodox Jews, have been very successful. They've created like self-sufficient communities that are economically independent, that have
mm-hmm.
high birth rates. Plus, what's remarkable is a lot of them, they're in urban areas like LA and New York. They're not.
Yeah, it's amazing,
like,
and they actually are able to protect their children from sexual degeneracy too. I've heard it said that a lot of Orthodox men don't learn about where babies come from until the night before their marriage. And this is in New York. This is in Flatbush. This is, you know, it's hard to believe, but it's possible. They actually do protect their young from the poisonous culture around them.
Is there anything else in your book that we haven't touched upon?
Gee, let's see. It begins with my sexual utopian power. We've discussed the economic aspect, which is dealt with in a very long essay called Home Economics, which is a kind of a companion piece. We've discussed sexual atavism in the modern West, back to Africa. We've discussed female masochism. I do have a long essay in there on what I would call the female version of the sexual counter-revolution. A lot of women are focused on holding out for a wedding ring, which I is not something I'm against by any means, though I think it's superficial to think that that's the only thing that needs reforming, that if women were just to hold out until marriage and not to have sex before marriage, that some people think that that's going to solve everything. I don't, and I explain why in a rather lengthy essay in the book.
I was
so that's
reading
another thing you can learn about. Go ahead.
There's this blogger he's a Christian, he's Dalrock, he's a Christian social conservative who's kind of a manosphere type.
Yes, he's the best of the Christian bloggers on this subject that I know of.
He said there's a phenomenon among Christians where a lot of men are staying celibate until marriage, and then they end up marrying women their own age who have been on a very different path.
Yes, yeah. I wouldn't consider that good at all. I think we need to go back to a society where men expect a woman to be a virgin. Think that, you see, women have a tendency, because they're the supply side of sex, they have a tendency to want to overestimate the value of sex, since they see it as their ultimate weapon, that they can withhold sex. And this is what I say in this essay. I don't think it's going to work. I think that with especially with the existence of prostitution and porn, a lot of guys really are not going to have their behavior changed by women holding out for wedding rings. Some of them don't want to get married because they know what lies ahead of them in divorce court. You know, there are all kinds of reasons that men don't get married. It's not just a matter of in other words, men are not completely motivated by sex, despite what some superficial observers and a lot of women want to think.
And you make the argument that in your book that social conservatives say there's too much sex, but you said there's too little sex.
Yeah, I think there probably is. I mean, I doubt there can be much more sex than a society where 99% of men and women get married, which is what we had at one time. It was very rare at one time to be a single person, a lifelong bachelor or a spinster. When women will only mate at the top of the pack, there's going to be less sex available to men in general. There's going to be more available to a very few men, the men who always found it easiest to get sex. What the sexual revolution does is it strengthens the stronger. It strengthens the hand of the very attractive man who has no trouble getting women anyway. He can now get multiple women. But the great mass of men, it's harder to get a woman than it was before. So, yes, it's a redistribution of a more or less fixed amount of sex, not an increase in the total amount of sex available.
I hear that a lot in the different various blogs. Is there actual scientific data that can back that up?
Empirical data, no. And I admit my argument is sort of a priori. It's based on essentially evolutionary psychology and the behavior of other primates. I think you would find it could be backed up. I don't know if any sociologists are working on that. One of the problems is it's hard to get young men to admit that they're not scoring with 20 chicks at the same time, because there's this kind of pluralistic ignorance. Every guy thinks that every other guy is getting loads of sex, and in fact, it's only a fairly small number of guys of whom that's true. So, I don't know how easy it would be to do an empirical study of this, but I'd be very interested in seeing any research of that nature.
We've covered a lot of very interesting topics. Roger Devlin, it's been great. I'd like to thank you for being on.
Let me mention before we ring off that my book is available on Amazon for $3.50 in Kindle. Only $20 in paperback, but $3.50 in Kindle. It's pretty cheap for a lot of good material that'll give you a lot to think about. I'll tell you one more thing, funny. When my book came out, there was a flurry of sales, and the Kindle edition of this book did so well that for a brief moment, it was the number one selling book on Amazon in the category feminist theory. I was ahead of Gloria Steinem. So anyway, get me back up there. Go buy A Sexual Utopian Power at Amazon or from countercurrents.com.
Have you gotten any publicity from like mainstream media sites?
Dalrock publicized me because I was going to send him my book, and I'm doing some signing events. I did one in New York, and I'm going to be doing one in Philadelphia and the D.C. area. Anybody who's interested in seeing me there, contact Greg Johnson at Countercurrents. He's the one who's arranging it. That'll be in August. And other than that, it's mostly word of mouth. I mean, most of the mainstream media is pretty closed to me, but we actually are developing a subculture and promoting one another's books, so to speak.
So, Roger Devlin, it's been an excellent show. We've covered a lot of really fascinating topics.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it. I look forward to speaking to you again sometime. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks again for being on. That's all we have for today's show, so take care. I'm back the next time.